Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Spanners Reddy. I'm joined by Matt Two Rumpets. Well, not right now, but Matt was with me when we recorded these interviews just for a bit of midweek content. So something a bit different this week. We're going to catch up with Peter Wright from Digital Law UK, who's been on several times to talk to us about legal issues in and around F1 and motorsport. Today, we're talking about driver contracts. What happens when things go wrong, when people need to part ways? How does that legally work? And we've got some great recent examples to point to as well. But we're going to start the show by catching up with my friend Magnus Greaves, who I'm hoping will be a regular panelist on the show. He's in Canada. He owns and runs an FIA-accredited magazine, which we're going to talk about a little bit as well. And we're going to talk about some of the great locations in Formula One as well. Heritage sites, new wave circuits, and party cities as well. Party venues. Where'd you go for a party? Anyway, it's a nice chat. I know you're going to like him. So here's Magnus Greaves. I started off by welcoming him to the shed. Thank you so much for joining us, Magnus. I've been delighted with the magazines you've sent us, and I've been looking forward to this chat for a while.
I've been looking forward to it too. Thank you for having me.
Race Weekend magazine. Let's talk about the magazine a little bit, because ultimately I would like to tempt some of our listeners to go check it out. It's not like, you go to your local news agents and you pick up the magazine and it's got some press release bits in it. The magazines you're putting out are like, they're conversation pieces. You put them on your coffee table, and I feel posh because I've got it on like our table. If the wife invites people around, they go, oh, what's this? You know, and it's an interesting conversation piece with big photos, and it's huge as well. It's like A1 size.
It is massive. Yeah, you know, I always just felt that Formula One was such a good-looking sport, such an exciting sport, but a lot of the media around it tends to focus on the technology and the news and the results. And I thought there was something missing. So we decided to create Race Weekend. So our whole goal is to explore the circuits, the cities, the culture of Formula One. So big entry points to look at the sport. And it's a big sport. So we thought it deserved a big magazine. So it's a very large format, lots of huge pictures, but also we try and go just as deep in terms of, on the editorial side when we take on these big topics.
Yeah, okay. Well, look, you know, you're not going to the nuts and bolts of, well, the nuts and bolts. What kind of other topics do you explore? I know you do a lot of like location stuff, for example.
Yeah. So when we had a previous publication, we focused each issue on one individual location, but we actually thought we could do a bit more than that. So the first issue that we've done with Race Weekend is called the Jet Set issue, Jet Set Formula One. So we'd look at all of the different amazing host destinations, all the different cities that host Formula One races, and explore what that experience is like for somebody who's going to go, and actually, why is that a Grand Prix host city? You know, what does it contribute to Formula One and being a fan if you get to go?
Well, they contribute presumably a big cash payment to Liberty for one thing. But when you're a fan thinking about where you want to go, the location is actually quite important. I wonder how many people pick, say, because they want to go out in the vineyards of Italy as much as they want to see the home straight at Monza when they choose to do that trip.
Yeah, and I think this is the thing, is if you ask most people, especially people that are new to the sport, which race, if you could go to one race, what would it be? Most people are going to say Monaco, because that seems to be the most glamorous. But actually, as much as I love Monaco and the unique things that it has to offer, I think for most fans, that actual experience in Monaco isn't going to live up to what they hope it to be, unless they have a few mates with super yachts, which I don't think most people do.
All right. Well, he's triggered me straight away. All right, Magnus, let's talk about Monaco, because I constantly have it shoved down my neck that you just have to be there, my darling. You have not experienced Monaco until you've smoked a cigar from the Duchess's shoe. Is it really? Will it change my mind when you eventually send me as your Monaco reporter to go and report for your magazine? Will it change my mind? Will it blow me away?
Yes. In short, it will, but provided you're going on somebody else's dime. I think the actual physically being there and seeing those tight streets, I think you gain a much greater appreciation, right, in terms of the size and the speed of the cars and the skill that it takes to go around Monaco, the backdrop of the harbor, the yachts, all the cool things that are going on. It's amazing. But I think logistically, you're most likely not going to be staying in Monaco. You're not going to necessarily be partying in Monaco. You're going to feel a little bit outside of the interaction. And I think you kind of get more bang for the buck elsewhere. But it's definitely a bucket list item. But this is the thing I find most interesting, too, is that Formula One is kind of a bizarre sport in that 95% of the fans will only go to one race or perhaps no race in their lifetime.
Yep.
Right. So that one race, you want to make sure you choose it correctly. And I think, you know, if you look at the wonderful Netflix show, it does a great job of making everything look glamorous and exciting. But the truth of it is, a lot of the races that you go to, there's not necessarily that much glamour to be found. Or if it is, it's hidden and not easily accessible. So that's why in the Jet Set issue, we broke it down, right? You need to think about what type of experience you want. So we look at it as there's heritage circuits, there's what we call the classic revivals, there's the new wave of Grand Prix destinations, and then there are actually a handful of party cities. So depending on what you're looking for, there's ones to go to, ones to prioritize, and ones that maybe won't interest you.
Oh, that's interesting. Let's start with heritage then. When you were talking about maybe the tracks like Nürburgring GP, Silverstone, for example. So we were at Silverstone, me and Brad, on the Friday, and I've been there. I was there in 2013 as well. So when you go for a weekend at Silverstone, I've also watched like WEC and stuff there. You need to be prepared to yomp. You know, you need to be there in your walking shoes, not a shirt, a t-shirt, sunscreen. You know, you need to be ready for like a physical day because it's so big. But that's completely like, I'm not saying Towcester isn't a party city, but you go to Silverstone to yomp around a racetrack.
No, but this is exactly my point. When I went to Silverstone, I went when I lived in London, but I also went when I was here in Vancouver and I traveled over. And you can have an amazing time at the circuit at Silverstone. But as soon as you leave,
it's done.
It's kind of over.
Like Northampton.
Yeah, that and people, there's no sort of central hub for everybody to stay, which is going to create a natural party atmosphere. People are sort of spread out all over the place. It takes forever to get there. And then, the Formula One atmosphere. So I still had a great time in the evening, but it wasn't a Formula One infused great time in the evening. You know what I mean? I was doing wonderful English activities as opposed to feeling like I'm in this forever celebration.
But some people will argue, of course, the campsites at Silverstone are where you go to have that kind of party atmosphere. Well, but much like why I don't like going to other people's houses, I also don't like going to campsites. I'll let you imagine the rest.
Yeah, that can be a bit tricky. But that's what we're saying as well, is that if you're into that and willing to go down that camping path, you know, then Silverstone is a great one for you. Just like Spa, the best time you can have is if you stay in the campsites.
Have you been to Spa? Because that's on my list.
No, that's actually, I've been to about a dozen of the Grand Prix, but that's at the top of my list, near the top of my list of ones that I haven't been to that I want to go to. But on our team, somebody from our team has been to every single race. So that's how we have the inside look at it.
Okay, I just want to get into the mechanics of how your team works, since you've mentioned it. You are FIA accredited, your organization. Correct. So that's super fancy to start with. That's like proper big boy stuff. And I'm super jealous. But what does that enable you to do? Does that mean you get a guy in the paddock? Can you put a microphone in someone's face? What does your accreditation allow?
Yeah, so that allows me or one of the members of my team to go to the race, be in the paddock, and be in the media center, you know, which then gives you opportunities to interview people and get up close to the action. So, listen, it's fantastic. It's amazing. That said, when I go to a Grand Prix, what happens outside of the circuit is just as important to me, to sort of take it in and see what that city is all about. But then also at the Grand Prix, not to be all caught up and excited with myself that I'm in the paddock, but actually go around the grandstand areas, which is where all the fans are and where so much more of the fun takes place. And that's important to point out too, is that in this issue, we're not looking at it from the privileged position of being in the paddock and doing all that. We're looking at it from every angle. Most people at the race will be in the grandstand. So what's that experience like? What's the fan zone like? What's it like to get to the circuit from the city if you're not in a chauffeur-driven car, but you got to take a bus or a shuttle or walk or come a different way?
Yeah, you've got to have experience as well of like the general admission and stuff like that. So Silverstone 2013, I was meant to be going with a friend who pulled out last minute. So I was there on my own on the Sunday. And in the general admission, found it very hard to see anything. I found a spot and I was leaning up against an old football stadium, kind of just a metal bar. Yeah, so it's like a metal fence, like metal bar. So I'm leaning on that and I'm like, I can't do anything. I can't go and get a drink. I can't go and get a pint because I'm going to lose this spot.
Right.
So I guarded that spot. I stayed there. Where the race was about to start. Cars were coming out on track. The people sitting down in front of me went, right, here we go then. Stood up and sat on the thing I'd been leaning against, completely blocking my view.
No.
And everyone had done that. So apparently like everyone knows that. So I'm like, man. Grand Prix, but so I had to go. I couldn't have done that this year. 2013, I had to go to the ticket office and last minute shell out another 90 quid for a seat at Farm. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to see. But it's stuff like that that you need to experience as well for your...
Exactly. And what's great about what we do is that we don't sell the magazine via newsstands or any of those traditional methods. People come directly to us via our website. They buy the magazine, which means... everybody that has the magazine, I have their email, they have mine. There's a lot of conversation going on. So when people read about this, you know, they share their experiences at different venues. So we're collecting a lot of information that we can then share with other people. It's just, and that's what you rely on. You rely on tips as well.
Well, if you want to interview me about my 2013 Silverstone experience, you're more than welcome.
And I've made a note of it.
And I can compare that to the 2021, where me and Brad were invited into the Paddock Club for the Friday. Very different.
Right. Yeah. And that's the thing I find too about the, you know, the paddock and the paddock club, which is a fantastic thing to do. But if you go to every single race on the calendar and you just look at it from the perspective of a paddock club.
Yes, please.
You might like that a little bit, but it does look the same, right? It does look the same. It's the same perspective.
Well, me and Matt have both been ruined, haven't we, Matt? Because you had that equivalent at the Formula E race and now it's going to be hard to go back. Don't make us go back.
Yeah.
We will have to. Anyway, right. You described different kinds of locations and cities. I'm interested in this. You said the heritage one. So I think you kind of talked about it's the ones on people's bucket list, isn't it? It's the Suzukas. It's the Nürburgrings. It's the Spas.
Exactly. It's the ones that really sort of speak to the history of Formula One and the ones that have been on the calendar for an extremely long time and contribute something sort of deep and historical. And I think if that's what people are looking for, to feel like you're doing some type of pilgrimage to F1, those are the ones that you go to. Similarly, we have what we look at as the classic revivals. So venues that were on the calendar a long time ago, maybe came off for a while, but came back and were modernized. So, the perfect example of that is Zandvoort, which is number one on my list, because even when a race looks amazing on TV in terms of the atmosphere, you know that in person it's going to be, unbelievable. I see you wincing there, but
yeah, just like wear orange, learn some Dutch. I think Matt, just for personal safety,
you're going to have to go incognito to that one, I'm afraid.
Yeah, you might have trouble. I'll go. I'm looking forward to it.
But I'm also intrigued as to what constitutes a party city. Is this a way we're going to pick a party venue to go to, and we're going to paint the town red, as I know you can. Where are we going? Where's our party destination?
Well, so this is interesting too, is that there's you can have a party that's just a party, or you can have a party that makes you appreciate that you're in a Formula One atmosphere still. So, and I know you're going to say I'm biased because I'm Canadian, but the easiest place to get that is Montreal. In Montreal, the whole city, first of all, it helps when the circuit is in the city or attached right to the city, right? So you don't lose a lot of atmosphere when you leave. Montreal, the whole city loves the Grand Prix, and it turns into an F1 themed party. The restaurants have F1 themed events, clubs have events, cafes, the city's decorated. Even when you land at the airport, I remember one time there was a baggage handler wearing a sort of fake F1 outfit. So the whole thing is taken over, and Montreal is just a great city for going out anyway. So in terms of especially for all the new American fans from the Netflix show, like, that's an easy one. I'll put a lot of money. Austin is a great party city as well, but because it's just a great party city any day of the week, any day of the year, it's not necessarily a Formula One themed party, but you'll definitely have an amazing time there. I think the one that I'm looking forward to that's going to take it to a whole new level is Miami. I think that has all of the ingredients.
When is Miami?
For a perfect Grand Prix.
When's that on the calendar?
May.
Oh, May.
I saw May 8th, but I don't think that's necessarily official yet. May 9th is my birthday, so I think I'll have to take that one in properly.
I don't really know North America. Is Miami, is that right next to you? Is that next to Brooklyn?
It is the furthest place from me, but it's worth the journey. But it's a straight shot from Brooklyn, though. You'll be fine.
Oh, okay. So because it's hot there, isn't it? And it's all beachy. So
but it's more than that, though. It's the mix of cultures that you have is incredible, right? Everybody in the United States is happy to go to Miami because they know what's there. People will come from South America. It's the gateway to South America. Europeans won't have much of an obstacle mentally wanting to go over there as well. So you have a whole mix of people. And Liberty, this is one of the things I find interesting, is that Liberty, it talked about making every Grand Prix a Super Bowl, right? Well, that hasn't yet happened.
Don't know what that means.
Yeah. Well, and what that means is something that only Miami knows, because Miami has actually hosted a Super Bowl. And what that means is 100,000 people will come for your race, but 500,000 people will come to your city just for the parties. So you need to make sure that the city is fully embracing it and has themed events and things going on, and that's super accessible. And I think, Miami is an incredible place. And I think from conversations I've had, they're going to approach the experience for the fan in a completely fresh way. So I'm excited about that one.
Okay. I'm tempted by that one, but Project Beachbody Spanners it's a whip. It's a work in progress.
Okay.
So we'll have to see where we are after Christmas. It's a very damaging time for that project.
Most party cities tend to be very sunny, so you keep doing those push-ups.
Okay. Oh, well. It's not the push-ups, mate. It's the arm action from the dinner table. Okay. That's the main factor. Okay, so we've got our party city sorted. I think I'm with you, Miami. So for heritage, you and I, we've got to go to Spa. We're traveling the world together next year.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Spa has got to be on our list. I want to see the dip, down towards Eau Rouge and up, especially if they're going to remodel that at some point as well. Before it goes, before it disappears, we want to get that. So we're gonna do that. We're gonna have a lot of European food. It's all sausage based, basically. Yeah. And then we're gonna party in Miami.
Yes.
I hope it's the other way around, so I haven't got my spa sausage weight on when we're on the beach.
Miami is gonna be in May, so we'll do the European races in the summer.
Roger that. Yeah. So where are we going in the new wave of tracks? And what do you mean by new wave?
So the new wave is super fascinating to me. So you have places like Baku, obviously the new race in Jeddah, Shanghai, you know, some of these newer venues, which for me is incredible because it gives you an opportunity to travel to places that you might be interested in just from a sort of social cultural perspective anyway. We put Singapore in there, but really Singapore is also a party city. But I'm really intrigued to see where you can see so much about Formula One's history, development, and future when you look at the change of the calendar.
My goodness,
the 70s to now to where it's pointing at going forward. You know, and I think at the moment, you know, a lot of the European races are struggling with the fee and the business model. So we'll see where it goes.
Well, we were chatting with this with Matthew Carter, and we've chatted with Joe from time to time. And there's definitely, obviously, with Liberty, a push to get the low-hanging fruit that Matthew Carter described in North America, which they've done. So that means you want North American tracks to complement that. You need to have the European heritage tracks for the history and the popularity of it. They're a big draw as well. And then in the Middle East, they have got the cash and the increasing influence in F1 to bring it to their location, to their doorstep. But you think maybe where you're going to suffer is, like, where have all the Asian tracks gone? You know, like China, India, Korea, all of those tracks, they're the ones that are going to miss out.
Well, I know that there were some complicated business issues with India, but that'd be amazing if it could get back there. China is one of the two growth areas, you know, like the United States. And next year, there's going to be two races in the United States. At some point, there will be two races in China, I'm sure. You know, that race in Shanghai is super interesting. I went to that, and that was fascinating. You know, it was a little tricky logistically because it's actually about an hour outside of where you'll stay in Shanghai. But to see Shanghai finally, and to see it in that context, and to meet fans at the race was fascinating. And, you know, for each of the locations, we break it down in three ways. We look at the circuit experience. We look at the city action and the X factor. So, you know, what is your experience like at the city? Some places, like in Melbourne, it's like nonstop fun action. There's so many different things going on, but then some venues don't quite have the full complement of support races, and the food offering might be a bit, you know, like for instance, when I went to Sochi, I was disappointed to see so many, you know, hot dogs and hamburgers for sale. I was looking for some real interesting local regional food, you know, but again, places like Melbourne just appreciate that people are traveling and it's our opportunity to introduce them to their country. You know, city action, as I said, some cities are just great no matter what, but some of them are really close to the circuit and there's a lot of overlap, a lot of spillover, which is terrific. And then X factor, we try and look at like, what's the one unique thing that this venue holds over somewhere else. And it's also interesting because if you don't have a home team and a home stadium and a home venue, you know, and you're going to choose one race to go to, if you live in New York, you're just as likely to go to a European race as you are to, you know, Miami.
Yeah.
Right. So these different Grand Prix circuits sort of compete against each other to offer something different, you know, and then that's played out with the ticket options and the hospitality options as well.
Okay, so I'm okay. I'm sorted for next year because I'm going to 4 Grand Prix of the 3 that we've discussed on our world tour. It's definitely going to happen. And no one tell my wife I'm planning this. And then obviously we've got to, at some point, go to Monaco so you can convert me. And then I can snobbishly explain to other people that you just have to be there. Sorry, it's rubbish all weekend on telly. But rest assured, all the people you can see in the crowd are having a wonderful time.
We'll take a lot of pictures.
And breathe. But I'm sorted for that. But if you're not going to 4 Grand Prix next year, I really can recommend your magazine, your publication. I know we focused a lot on the locations, but also you know, you've the recent episode is a 70s edition, and you've done lots of other different stuff like that. It is a premium product, and you price it accordingly. But it is when they're in our house, it feels like it's part of the furniture, if I'm honest with you. And Magnus is not paying me to say this. It's a genuine compliment. It feels like a feature in my house.
Well, look, I appreciate that. A couple of things. It's for the whole family, right? So it's, if you're a hardcore fan, you like it. But if somebody in your family is new to the sport from Netflix, they can get a lot out of it as well. You can take it on board in terms of the, get yourself lost in the photographs from the great archives of photos that we can dip into, or we also try and tell a pretty meaty story. We don't have ads in there. Like I said, we go directly to fans. So it's $100. You get four issues, and we've just made shipping free in the United States, Canada, and England. So come on. It's actually good value. When you break it down, it's supersized. It's worth it. Come on.
I'll have a tweet. In fact, I'll tweet the picture I sent you of my son, who, when it arrives at the door, just ran off with it just for a comparison on size. But I do owe you, because a Red Bull staffer gave my boy an annual, one of those Red Bull annuals at the end of the year, and he jealously guards it in his room, and it turned him into a Max Verstappen fan, which I'm sure you can imagine how that's gone down in my house. But at least your publication, it keeps him away from that darn Red Bull book. So I'm grateful at least for that. We will put a link to your publication in our show notes as well.
Yeah, and the second issue we have out right now is F1 in the 1970s. So that was the decade that created modern Formula One in terms of sponsorship, businesses, just the modern business that we know today. We have Formula One in the USA coming out next month to coincide with Austin. And we're doing a lot of stuff in Austin, which is going to be great. And then the fourth issue this year is going to be Formula One champions. So we're going to look at some of the legends in terms of drivers and teams that have been championship winners over the decades.
Okay. There is a price to pay for your appearance here and talking about your magazine. I do expect you to jump on our news panels as well and be a panelist going forward for Missed Apex from time to time.
I can. I'm not so good at talking about tires, but I'll do my best.
No, it's okay. We'll pick one when Matt's on holiday. It'll be okay. Magnus Greaves, Race Weekend Magazine, thank you so much for your time, and we'll see you again soon.
Thanks, guys.
Hopefully hear more from Magnus very soon. Okay, now it's time to turn our attention to the legal ins and outs of Formula One driver contracts. This is Peter Wright. In the law world, he's kind of a big deal. He's a big boy. And he's graced us with his time several times now on Missed Apex. We're always grateful to have him. But do you know what? Here I am. What am I going to do? I'm going to give away too much. Here we go. Just listen to the chat. It's good. Peter Wright. I started off by welcoming him to the shed. Peter, thank you so much for spending some of your very expensive time with us.
No, it's great to see you. Great to be back. And can I just ask on behalf of the listeners as well, because I'm a listener, right? I listen to the race reviews and everything. And I know from having voicemails from you how ill you've been. Are you okay? Are you all right?
I'm so grateful that you asked. And yes, I sent you a series of voice notes when I had to cancel the show last week. Like, Peter, I think maybe I can do the show. And you're like, no, we're not doing the show. Go to bed. And a couple of the shows, Matt has been on absolute standby. And you may have noticed that during the previous race review before Monza, or was it the previous show before Monza, Matt, that you had to take over for about 5 minutes? The listeners wouldn't have seen, but I had my face in the aircon unit desperately trying to cool down.
Yes, you entered one of your boil in a bag phases right during the middle of the show. And we were like, yep, you go ahead and do what you need to do. We'll take care of it.
Well, thank you for asking. I am in the first day, though, of feeling properly alert and bright. I've gone to see a friend. I'm working, and hopefully everything is back on track. Please avoid shaking hands with people and hugging your nan for a little bit, because I still think we might be in just a little bit of trouble in the UK. But on to legal contracts. Really interesting conversation we had about a month ago. And actually what kicked it off is we were talking about Daniel Ricciardo and his career at McLaren actually not going very well. So the whole linchpin of our discussion was, can you get rid of a driver mid-season? And then of course, he goes and wins the very next race. But that is still an interesting talking point, which is how locked in to these contracts drivers really are and what happens when things aren't working out.
The joy of Formula One events that can make discussions age very, very quickly if you aren't careful. But I think it did raise, like you say, a really interesting question. And funny enough, I was thinking about it when I think you had Joe on either the last time or the time before, and he mentioned at one point, oh, so-and-so has got an ironclad contract.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's an interesting phrase.
Is there such a thing as an ironclad contract in sport?
There's a legal answer that I think everyone needs to know, and sometimes you can end up, you know, paying huge amounts of money to the most skilled and highly qualified lawyers in the world, and they'll come back to you with an answer, which is, well, it depends. And indeed, it does indeed depend on so many different factors in terms of, is a contract really going to be something you can rely on? And a huge amount of it, in particular in motorsport, in particular in Formula One, always is going to come down to the goodwill of the parties. And I mean, it was always clear that McLaren was certainly going to be putting a lot of time and investment into Ricciardo. You do not bring a driver in on a significant salary, a significant investment like that, and not give him the time. So even if we were discussing this before Monza, it would always have been, well, they're going to give him a lot of time, and surely at some point he's going to come good, would probably have been our discussion. And sure enough, a matter of hours later, he has. So there you go.
But obviously it's different with, you know, even in presenting and stuff. If let's put aside the miracle win of Monza, which was well earned, you know, when it's a performance related kind of contract, if I suddenly came online and put my radio show into disrepute, there's probably clauses for that. But what if I'm just not very good? Perish the thought.
And that's just it. I mean, that comes down to a principle of generally employment law, full stop, is that you always will have elements of, well, is someone actually doing the job? And if they're not, you end up coming into areas of performance management. It's different in Formula One in that, of course, we're looking here not open-ended relationships, but contracts that are always time limited. And increasingly, they've also got those sort of performance clauses in there. Very often, there's quite a lot anyway in terms of performance, but it's more on, for example, the driver being specifically rewarded in the event that certain criteria are met. You know, if a point is scored, then the driver will probably receive a either a bonus or performance-related pay related to that point. Similar thing then, podium, win, etc. It was very clear, even back in the Braun days, I remember that I think it was clear that when Jenson Button started going on that run of races, that it wasn't just him getting a bonus. I think it was the team as well. So, of course, everyone's got a spring in their step, turning up to work on Monday, knowing that you've just won. Because everyone's like, oh, great, you know, we've all done well. We've all seen some other rewards. So sometimes you get those sort of collaborative elements in driver contracts as well. Usually, though, in terms then of that sort of defined performance, there's less about, well, if they fail to achieve something, their seat might be in danger. Though I'd love to see exactly what it says in a Red Bull driver contract, because clearly they start to panic after just quite a few, yeah, only a short number of races, where suddenly they're starting to think, I might have trouble here. And that almost seems to add to the pressure. And just from a psychological perspective, I think I thought it was fascinating to see that Valtteri Bottas, after a number of races where we've thought, he really seems to be struggling, the minute that his future has been resolved, it's in his best race that I think I've seen him in a Mercedes. It was back to how consistent and quick he was as a Williams driver. I found that revelatory. And I did hear Damon Hill on a podcast saying that he found that when he was in a real tight spot in 95, his performances definitely dipped due to the sheer performance and the pressure that was being put on. So,
okay, I don't want to, I get the general point, actually, because I mean, it's the same in a media contract as well. I behave differently and feel very differently as I'm coming to the end of a year contract or seeing if I'm going to get renewed. And then when you know you've got a year in your back pocket, you can be a little bit more experimental and kind of act with less fear, if you like, of losing out. The only slight issue I'll take, and we'll see if Matt backs me up on this, is that Bottas, I think, had a fresh power unit at a very power-dependent track, which people seem to slightly undervalue. I find it a bit of a coincidence that, yeah, he's really struggled in actually in qualifying, where he's been generally competitive against Hamilton. He's not been so on it. And then he's not struggled with the tyres like he has, or apparently not. But then he didn't have Hamilton to compare to. He wasn't running at the top of the field. I just think that the super Bottas at Monza is slightly over-egged. I know I'm a hater.
I think I was going to say, I thought his performance when it came through to, I think it was Monza a year ago when he ended up being stuck in midfield and just couldn't move forward. Whereas to see him do it this time was great. But I absolutely admit that in terms of engine and Matt's chosen subject, special subject of tyres, obviously, that's going to change things a bit. But for once, the stars aligned. When was the last time we saw Valtteri put in a race with a number of overtakes like that? And I don't think that's entirely just down to the car being in that sweet spot and the performance. He was absolutely on it.
I'm sure the psychological aspect of that is very high, Matt. I just wanted to throw my little caveat in the ring.
No, I understand your caveat. And the response I have to that is that, yeah, I do believe the power unit made a difference, but we also saw him in a position where he could not really be effectively used as a tool in Lewis Hamilton's championship pursuits. And we haven't seen him in too many races in that position. I think it's a good and healthy reminder of exactly what he brought to the table and why Mercedes has kept him as long as they have.
Yeah. The psychology of Bottas aside, let's go back to the ironclad contract. So let's do the alternate universe where Ricciardo doesn't win at Monza. In fact, he gets caught outside a nightclub, needlessly punching a ferret, and the performances have gone down. And McLaren just decide, we've had enough. And not only are your performances not good, but we love ferrets. What can they do? Is there, because Ricciardo can't turn around and go, well, I've got a contract for this seat, it's my seat, bog off. Presumably they could replace him if they wanted to.
Well, let's look at some precedent where you've had drivers suddenly radically fall out with teams. Don't forget it was McLaren with Fernando Alonso in 2007, whereby after that year, he was just summoned to Woking after the end of the season. And they said, right, you have another year's contract, but we're paying you up. Here you go. Thank you very much. Goodbye. So that's where you get that sort of catastrophic loss of faith by one party in the contract.
I didn't actually realise Alonso had a contract for 2009.
2008.
For 2008. Oh, my goodness. So he has to give up the championship. I'd missed that somehow in my F1 fandom. And then so to see Lewis Hamilton then win the title in his car in 2008 must have been extra crushing.
Particularly when they then brought in Heikki Kovalainen as a sort of a teammate they knew would not rock the boat and hopefully just form an adequate understudy to Lewis. And then he's probably sat there thinking, well, I'm many, many times over a stronger racer. I don't think, despite the whys and wherefores of Fernando's career, no one would dispute his ability behind the wheels. It must have been utterly galling to think there is, you know, a car that can win world championships. And unfortunately, I've talked myself out of the seat.
Well, there you go.
Talked action. It's that whole package of that, you know, tumultuous 2007 season that meant that he didn't get the second year of his contract.
Just think, Matt, if he'd have been in there with Lewis Hamilton and instead of Kovalainen, Massa's world champion.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I love the way you stretch the definition of the word adequate with Kovalainen as a teammate there. But my larger
general... He won one race.
In a championship winning car, but yes.
Yeah.
I want to ask, if I'm a Formula One team and I've not previously negotiated this as part of the driver's contract, because I remember Raikkonen too, I think, got 2 years of paid leave from Ferrari to go crash, you know, rally cars and NASCAR trucks and things like that. Am I always, as the employer in this instance, able to tell my driver, you know what? for whatever reason, we don't want you in the seat anymore. Here's all your money. Go have fun. We're bringing in somebody else. Or is there a point at which a driver can put up a legal fight and say, no, I'm sorry. I get that you've lost faith in me, but I feel I'm still entitled to this seat. And I'm going to bring my expensive high-priced lawyers and make you pay in court costs, if nothing else, for the right to do this.
So that's a very, very good question. And I think the closest that Formula One's got to that exact scenario was with Guido van der Garde and Sauber a few years ago when he turned up at the first race of the season saying, I have a contract for this season. But it turned out that Sauber had already signed two other drivers as well. And one of the issues was jurisdiction, because, of course, when it comes to then, well, actually, I'm going to enforce this. Where are you going to do it? So he actually went to court in Australia. And the court agreed, yes, you have a contract. And I think he then turned up, I think, P1 or P2 in Melbourne saying, right, the court agrees and you have to give me a seat. But, of course, the team simply didn't want to do it. They had signed their two other drivers, so the atmosphere wasn't, I think, particularly conducive to running an efficient race team. And sure enough, that was just it. They ended up then doing exactly what you've just said and reached a settlement. So I think money probably changed hands, probably quite a bit of money, usually ends up changing hands in these scenarios to end up sort of greasing the wheels of the contract. I did not realize up until only a few days ago when I was listening to an interview with Eddie Jordan, and he was saying that something very similar happened with regards to Michael Schumacher and his second race. So after that first one in Spa, basically he did have a semi-agreement with Michael Schumacher for him to stay in the car. There ended up being a significant difference of opinion. But as far as Benetton were concerned and Bernie Eccleston got involved. And basically, Eddie stuck it out and got a significant financial payment for the loss of Schumacher to Benetton, which at least ensured that Jordan survived to the end of that season, which, if we think about it, is pretty crucial because they became a race-winning team ultimately are still on the grid today. But were it not for that agreement, they may not have been able to become the team that they did.
Hang on, for newer fans, for a bit of history, Jordan F1 won a race in Interlagos, but it wasn't awarded till afterwards. Was that the one?
They also, with Damon Hill, won in Spa in 1998 and with two races with Heinz Harald Frentzen in 1999 in what became a improbable challenge for the championship that probably never really on, but it was great to watch.
And what outfit is that now in modern F1?
So that ended up morphing through Midland and Spyker to then become Force India, which then became, what's it, Force Stroll or something at one point?
Yeah.
It's now Aston Martin. It's now Aston Martin. And
Racing Point, yeah. Racing Point.
007 decals all over it. And didn't they even have the Olympic sprinter with them in the pit in Monza? That's the level that they're at now. They had an 8-time Olympic champion in their pit lane. So, large trees grow from small acorns.
So that one court case is what will lead to Stroll eventually being world champion with Aston Martin. Interesting, the fascinating history of Formula One. I just wanted to cover that off. But with Guido van der Garde, it's a little bit different because he's a customer. And that's where you get into really kind of complicated areas. Like people like Guido van der Garde and Latifi are effectively buying their race seat. I know Lance Stroll is a pay driver, but he is paid. He's employed as a driver. So that one's the little caveat. And it's a bit different. But when you're a customer, you can kind of sort of sue, oh, I paid the thing and I didn't get what I wanted, which is odd for a competitive sport. But there you are.
Mm. And I can also just add in the exception that proves the rule, in that we've got the one driver that defies the general rule of pay drivers. And indeed, it's very difficult to define who they are. I mean, technically, you could argue that Lando Norris is a pay driver.
So I would say Lando Norris in F2, in the junior categories, would be defined as a pay driver. But then a team has looked at him and gone, yes, that's the talent we want in our team. Here's money to come and drive with no connection or obligation. To me, that's what makes it a paid driver. At that level, would you have that drive if not for the resources at that level? Pretty much all of them are paid drivers coming up through the ranks. So yeah, I agree the definition gets blurred, but I love the conversation about what makes a paid driver.
Yes, and that's not to take anything away either from Lando's achievements. I went to a touring car race recently and saw the Ginetta Juniors, which is like for those who are still at school to come along and race motor cars. And he won that in something like 2013 or 2014. And so, of course, the race commentators at circuit never tire of telling you about four times during the race, oh, Lando Norris did win this once, just to sort of prove its value. But it's still great entertainment. But the point is that, to get through that staircase of talent took a significant investment by his family. Mm. But, you know, if you've seen Rush, you know that Niki Lauda brought his way into Formula One by taking out a huge loan. You look at certain drivers, arguably even Senna and Alonso, got into F1 with massive backing from individual sponsors in their native countries as well. And it gets to the point, I think it's actually very difficult to define exactly, you know, is the driver solely there on talent, or is it down to commercial relationships as well? And increasingly, Formula One is a business. Mm-hmm. It's something that teams have to take on board, particularly in the current financial climate.
I know this isn't what we were planning to talk about, but Matt, my favourite definition of paid drivers is, when it comes to backing, are you getting that backing because of what you can do, or are you getting that backing because of who you are? So Stroll gets that backing because of who he is. Latifi gets the backing because of who he is. Perez, that's right on the borderline, because they were looking for a Mexican driver to sponsor and put money behind, but there was also a personal connection between Carlos Slim, I think, and the family too. Lewis Hamilton got his backing from McLaren, again, because of what he can do, not because there was some familiar connection there. So that, to me, that's the thing. Have you got the backing because you're good and people believe in you, or have you got the backing because of Uncle Jimmy?
Indeed. I mean, that is an important point to me. It's interesting, after the Italian Grand Prix, apparently there's even talk of Giovinazzi's seat at, what's it called now, AlphaTauri. There have been calls that the Italian
other one,
government
Alfa
should
Romeo.
Put him in there. Is it Alfa Romeo?
Yeah.
Alfa. and that's just it. They've said, should the Italian government end up paying for his seat to keep him in Formula One? Arguably, I think the Italian government have probably got other more pressing things to worry about with finances at the moment. But there's a lot of people who feel very strongly about that, not least the fact that you've got the Italian heritage in Formula One, and without him, you've suddenly not got an Italian driver on the grid. So, you know, you can, that also sort of stretches that definition to a certain extent, potentially.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult question to answer, because I think, unlike in years past, even if you are wretched from a Formula One point of view, you're still pretty darn good overall. But I think there is, especially for the smaller teams, a point of arbitrage where the money I can bring through my sponsor is worth more to the team than any extra points they could get because of the inherently, this year being a very big exception, anti-competitive nature of the sport. There's going to be a few teams at the top that take almost all of the points. And if you are not in that small window, then you're almost certainly better off betting on a driver who will bring you 30 or 40 or 50 million than betting on a driver who, if everything works out right, might bring you two or three extra points and possibly one step up in the Constructors' Championship, which is the only place there's money.
And so that's how Sauber sort of found themselves in that situation, Peter, I guess. Was it just the three drivers? I keep making the joke that Manisha Kaltenborn, thank you very much, had signed like eight drivers that season. But that was clearly was what they were driving at, was bringing in essentially customer drivers. So what was the legal basis of being able to let him go in the end? Was it just tough luck, here's some cash? If you're Guido van der Garde and you're a racer, you don't really want the cash. You're pushing to go, well, this was my seat, this was my chance to be in F1.
Exactly, and I'm afraid, in short, the short answer is... when it comes down to it, you just have the parties not in a position to want to follow through on the contract. So then it just becomes, here's some money to go away. And you'd actually be very surprised how many disputes ultimately it comes down to the parties agreeing a sum for something to be ultimately put to one side. So even though, I mean, you know, specific performance in this instance is, yeah, he's going to have a seat for a year. Specific performance simply was not on the cards. And it's quite fundamental in Formula One, as I say, that you've got the team wanting to put you in the car, wanting to make sure that everything is proper and safe and running properly and supporting and working closely with you. And if the practical will isn't there, very difficult to force people to do it. And by the same token, don't forget, we've had some years where drivers have walked away from full years in Formula One, Nico Rosberg yes. being a significant example.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that's a good direction to take it, actually. Then the drivers who walk away, if Rosberg had a contract, I guess he had a contract for 2017, is he in any legal trouble? I mean, you can't force someone to drive a race car, can you? I mean, that's the weirdest punishment ever, if you get forced to drive a race car.
So ordinarily, these things are pretty hefty documents that try and cover what's going to happen in any particular scenario. And more than likely, there was a break clause in there where you've got a contract for multiple years. And Nico, I think, was on a multi-year contract at that time. That would have a clause in there that says if one of the parties wishes not to proceed the following year, this is what will happen. So there was probably a... it's a good question, actually, in terms of whether Nico would have received a payoff for not racing, or indeed whether he may have received certain things in 2016 that then had to be returned. If there were, for example, signing on bonuses for, great, you've just signed on for your multi-year deal, here's a nice big bonus. And it could be that then because he didn't do the whole year, would he that have then been payable back? But then you also wonder, sometimes despite what's in the small print, fine print of a contract, the parties are still free to reach their own settlement. So it could well have been, you know, let's just stop it there. Let's walk away. There could have been payments. There could not have been. It would all come down to, as I say, the biggest element is the will of the parties, sometimes over and above what is actually in the contract. And of course, Mercedes and Nico, it was still amicable, ultimately. You know, would Mercedes want to have their reigning world champion in the car? Most definitely. Did they want to go through another year like they just had in 2016? Probably not, when you actually listen to the interviews with different engineers who were in that garage that year. So I think they would have had to resolve it in some way, shape or form. But I think Mercedes on balance would probably have rather kept him rather than have him walk away. And certainly they were so shocked that I think they certainly never expected him to walk away within hours of winning his first world championship.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, really what it's going to come down to is the party that is being jilted, because why not put it that way, it feels that they are experiencing a harm as a result of the other party's behavior. Like if Mercedes felt like Rosberg leaving would actively harm them, then their attitude might be different. And at a certain extent, are we just coming up against the fact that the general tendency in Formula One is we would rather settle this privately than air any kind of laundry? I mean, they are very, very secretive over there. Are we seeing not a lot of cases like this? Because at the end of the day, the teams especially feel like it's in their best interest to settle it where no one can really see what's going on.
Well, in particular where you've got Mercedes, a works team, you know, the board at Mercedes aren't going to particularly want to see headlines in either specialist or national press about their inner workings and consideration, in particular when you've got a great big list of blue chip sponsors as well who are paying huge amounts of money for nice positive headlines. So you very often see wielded the ubiquitous NDA, non-disclosure agreement, which is part of the contract, which basically says this is what the contract says and no one is going to be Yeah, this is what the contract says, and yeah. No one's actually going to refer to what these specific clauses are. And I think we've just seen an excellent example of that in the last couple of weeks with Bottas and Russell, who were constantly being asked things in the paddock, and whether they'd signed or not, they were subject to contracts that will have had NDAs in there, so they simply can't answer the questions until they are allowed to under the terms of any agreements.
Right. I want to ask one more question related to this. We've got Ocon, who's a Mercedes driver at Renault. We've now got Albon, who is a Red Bull driver, going to Williams, which has a Mercedes engine in it. And I've recently seen an article that they are still working on the contract because Mercedes is very concerned about protecting its intellectual property rights. How much is this kind of driver swapping going to complicate contracts and sort of the things that we've already been talking about?
I think that's a really good question. And I must admit, I've spent quite a lot of time thinking about the issue around Ocon, because obviously Mr. Carter has trailed extensively that he remains under a agreement of some sort with Mercedes and could end up sort of on a bungee cord pinging back to the Mercedes garage. But the fact that he's now on this multi-year deal with Renault has made me think that in the same way, I mean, we're hearing very publicly that Mercedes had a problem with Albon having that Red Bull agreement and going into the Williams garage. And I cannot think that Renault would have committed Ocon to a multi-year deal, multi-year investment in a talent and a driver without bottoming out the same arrangement. So if there is some very, very deep agreement, you know, multi-year management agreement in there with Mercedes that still would allow him to go to Renault and come back, I almost wonder if, have Renault done their due diligence? I would have thought they would. And there will be things in that contract that would supersede anything else that may have been signed or done earlier on. The Red Bull and Albon issue is different again. I thought it was interesting what Joe said on this, actually, when you had him on the other week, where he said, well, he has been burned by Red Bull twice. So should he necessarily feel an awful lot of loyalty, particularly when you look at how he was treated? So he might have actually been quite grateful for the opportunity to now lose that relationship with Red Bull and be able to now progress his career in an environment unencumbered by that.
Well, okay. But, yeah, I was going to say, most of the reports are that Red Bull have got an option for him for 2023 if they want. I don't even know what an option means. It's said all the time.
So let's unpack that a little bit. And don't forget as well, what I've just said there about non-disclosure agreements and, you know, commercial confidentiality and a lot of the massive commercial interests wrapped up in these agreements. If that's the case, can you imagine then that you'd freely be saying, oh, yes, we've got an option that says this and an option that said that, which makes me think that what's coming out from Red Bull there is more than likely a little bit of smoke and mirrors and a little bit of drumming up a story, a little bit of trying to destabilize Mercedes, because there's been, let's face it, an awful lot of that this year. And this is merely just opening up another front potentially by Red Bull to do that. I should put a caveat on all of the things we're discussing today, that this is, of course, based on our discussions and our opinions, and that none of us have seen any written contracts here, so we don't know for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And as we learn from you, just occasionally saying allegedly covers us for whatever we want. Like when the time I said that Ferrari allegedly cheated by delivering more fuel into their engine than was allowed. Because I said allegedly, I'm completely legally safe. It's what you've taught me.
Indeed. And hopefully you won't face any form of horrific enforcement from the FIA for saying that.
Oh, man, I'd love that. We could imagine the likes we'd get on Twitter if Ferrari sued us or the FIA.
Should we? But just before we move on, do you want to just quickly go into actually what an option is?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sorry, I forgot I'd even asked. Your answer was so long.
Because, and this is just it, an option is generally just that. It is not a contract. And I'm afraid a couple of months back you were on Mr. Apex saying an option is basically another year's deal, and I was just screaming at the radio, no, it isn't. An option is just that. It is an option to take up a driver's services for a year or for a period, or to basically say we have the option to potentially give them that seat. It's not giving them the seat, it's saying we are keeping you under option. That can then destabilize the market as a result. Quite often, drivers will sign an option with one team to drive up their value with another when they're in negotiations. So, you'll have to double my salary because I've got this great big option here from Ferrari and they're really interested in me. Can I have some more money, please? And that quite often can be quite an effective argument. The bluff, of course, is that the team boss then says, well, I've not got the money. If you don't like it here, clear off. Here's your cards. Thanks very much. P45's in the post, which is a tax form for those in overseas. But the point is that it is very much a sort of a light agreement. It wouldn't have all the terms in that we've just discussed, and all of the different mechanisms, but probably still subject to an NDA, of course. So, as I say, the chances of it actually being openly discussed in the media pen is going to be a lot less as a result.
Can an option then sometimes function as a way for a team that's sending a driver somewhere, let's say in the case of Albon, if I'm sending Albon there and he signs just like a right of first refusal, you at the end of this year, we have the right to re-sign you to our team if we insist. Does that then become a way of extracting extra value from that driver? Say Williams really want to keep him, Red Bull's like, well, okay, but now we're going to need a little bit of scratch here if we're not going to re-sign him.
Yes. I mean, you could potentially use it in that way, but it's the fact as well that they're notoriously difficult things to then necessarily rely on. If we're saying that even a contract can't necessarily be regarded as being ironclad, then an option definitely isn't. You know, you can't then turn around and say, I've got an option. And they say, well, tough, we've already signed two other drivers. It's just almost really the equivalent of a sort of gentle statement of intent, a prelude, but without going into the more detailed agreement that a contract would constitute. But it also, as I say, it's the fact that the issues around Red Bull and their driver program are so... you've got a sort of greater amount of politics around that as a whole in terms of how they manage their drivers, how they bring them up from the lower formula, how they end up dispensing with them. I mean, if we want to go through the list of Red Bull drivers over the years who've, you know, they've had wonderful contracts with Red Bull, and look what happened to Daniel Kvyat. You know, it's they aren't necessarily the most reliable of documents. So in this instance, as I say, I think it's more of a negotiating ploy and almost a way of trying to destabilize Mercedes by saying, look, he's still our driver, when in reality, he may not be.
Okay, so whilst we're on the subject of options then, and you said you were screaming at the TV at one point when we were talking about Lewis Hamilton's contract. So the way I saw it, and obviously I clearly don't understand the legal definitions. I know about when you scream objection. I know you occasionally have to call the witness a badger. I know all of those legal terms, so you don't need to tell me about those. But what I thought that you basically have a two-year contract that Lewis Hamilton had, but I guess there's like a get out clause after like 1 year or something. And like, if they both agree, then, you know, they carry on. So the option to me, it was kind of like, well, the default will be 2 years, but if something happens, like you can, I guess, leave after 1 year. But you seem to talk about it more in terms of, no, it was a 1 year contract and then they negotiate again for the second part. So A, what's the point of it being called an option? Just make it a 1 year contract. I thought the option part of it just takes away all that elongated negotiation. They just have to decide yes or no instead of like re-talking about money.
Yeah. So the 1 year, I think in that context, and this was the discussion, of course, with Lewis Hamilton's 1 year deal, which I don't think anyone a year ago envisaged, but COVID brought to pass. And that was a 1 year contract for this year only with a 1 year option for the following year. And I think that was very much Mercedes' way of making that public by saying it's only for a year, but if anyone has the slightest hint that they can poach and destabilize Lewis, don't think so, because we also have another option for the following year. I.e., this then allows us to actually get some time when all of our key staff and decision makers have recovered from COVID, and we can actually get a proper long-term driver contract in place to more than likely see out Lewis for the balance of his career.
That's funny, because I looked at that particular announcement as being, I might not win my eighth championship this year, so maybe I just better, you know, leave an iron in the fire just in case.
Before we let you go, I think something that people are very curious about now that George Russell has been officially signed with Mercedes is how does it work with equal treatment, number one, number two driver status? Can you order a driver to chill out a bit in the fight? I mean, there's loads of language from Mercedes saying, let's have George Russell continue his learning at Mercedes. Continue his learning doesn't scream, we're going to give you equal opportunities to go and fight Lewis Hamilton. It's kind of saying, serve your apprentice kind of period, get the bruise in, do your best, and when Lewis retires, you're out of here. But I mean, what can you do in a contract?
So there'll be things in there that aim to probably give him equal status in terms of equipment. And in fairness, Mercedes are generally pretty good at this. They tend not to turn up at the track and say, oh, well, we've got this new front wing. And we've got, you know, Lewis has got that this weekend, but you know, his teammate hasn't. They're pretty scrupulous and pretty efficient in terms of saying each car has the same equipment and we aren't prioritizing one driver's equipment over another. Whereas we know that sometimes Red Bull in their stampede to try and improve the car have turned up with parts solely for the lead Red Bull driver. And that has happened with other teams as well. They've just said, look, this is just the way we work. We've prioritized one of the drivers. In terms of then the sort of equal treatment and team orders, it's difficult to then have an awful lot in the contract about that, apart from, and there's probably actually clauses in both the lead, you know, both drivers, it will say, you agree to follow the instructions of the team. And that would come to the instance of, please let through your teammate who's on quicker tyres or a different strategy. But it would also mean, you know, you agree to act in the best interests of the team. You're both representing the team on the track. And there may be scenarios where in order to guarantee a good result for the team, another driver's prospects have to be burned. And we see that quite often. And I thought it was very interesting at the Hungarian Grand Prix, of course, that video message from George offering to sacrifice his race so that Nicholas Latifi could potentially score the team's first points of the year. Interesting he said that, and then interesting that Formula One chose to broadcast it as well out of all the thousands of messages over the course of that race. But I thought that was quite appropriate given probably the nature of the discussions he will have had with Mercedes in terms of, you know, they will probably have actually asked him, you know, will you just follow the instructions that come through? And we've heard over the last 6-7 years, lots of radio messages from Mercedes, lots of messages when it was Nico and Valtteri sometimes not happy with what the team was asking them. And they'll want to make sure that if necessary, George is willing to follow the same instructions.
So I just want to, again, like with Bottas, just put a little bit of a sprinkle of a caveat on that, which is George Russell is a PR machine. He knows the right things to say. He likes to come across as, you know, whiter than white, noble, gallant, in the same way that Lewis Hamilton likes to cultivate that kind of that drama. It's like, Lewis, you won by 4 laps. How was it? Oh, man, but my leg was falling off. And then there was like wind in my face and my eyeball disappeared for a moment. So that's a character trait, I think, of George Russell, Matt, is that he definitely has a very polished, he's always aware of his PR. It's not heart on sleeve at all with him. It is a manicured what is going out to the world. That's all. That's all I want to add to that.
Well, I'd just say, actually, that I'm not sure it's necessarily sort of PR. I think it's the fact that he's been incredibly well prepared as a Formula One driver. You know, he's come through that racing pyramid of different series in the UK, same as Lando, same as Lewis and a lot of the other drivers. But, you know, when you saw that picture of him as a fan looking for Lewis's autograph in, what was it, 2008, 2009, and looking on in awe as Lewis walks past, you see that the guy not only, you know, likes being a racer, he's also a fan. So he knows the game. He can play the game.
He's playing the game.
That's what he's doing.
He is playing the game. Trumpets.
Yeah, well, I just want to say that's one of the things to me that made the whole Imola collision with Bottas thing so very, very interesting, is I feel like we saw a side of Russell that he very rarely lets go of.
That's the side he doesn't want you to see, Matt, but we saw a little bit, and I think we'll see a bit more at Mercedes.
And speaking of Mercedes, I just want to ask, given how many times it's occurred for so many different teams, and I know even more than we usually even know about from chatting with Summers, I can't imagine there's not just a basic clause in every driver's contract that says, in the event we cannot bring some same parts for both cars, we reserve the right to allocate those parts based on, you know, championship point order at that time, which is basically them telling Russell, yeah, Hamilton will get the good parts if we can only turn up with one set of them.
Yeah, and I think that is sort of detailed in the answer Peter gave us before. Really interesting stuff. Really appreciate you coming on. There was no talk of a fee, thank goodness, because I can tell by your status in the world that I would not be able to afford this conversation. But people can hire you. You're like the A-team, can't they? If you go to, is it still Digital Law UK?
It's Digital Law. We did have a slight rebrand, but ooh, yes, we. If you go to @DigitalLawUK, that's my Twitter handle. And that's my firm, Digital Law. We do a lot of advice around e-commerce and doing things digitally and helping people sell products and services into new markets. When it comes to e-commerce, apps, websites, all that sort of stuff, we do lots of stuff around that. So that's us. And I do a lot of talk about technology and innovation as well. So if you're into any of that, give us a follow on Twitter.
Go give him a follow. None of this was legal advice, except the bit where he said, I definitely wouldn't get sued by Ferrari for suggesting they allegedly cheated a while back. Peter, thank you so much for your time. Come and join us soon again and enjoy the rest of the season. And that's all we've got for you this week. Thank you very much to Peter Wright and Magnus Greaves, and of course to Matt Trumpets for keeping me company during those interviews. Everything we talk about is always in the show notes below, so underneath the video, if you're on YouTube, or I think you'd like scroll right on Pocket Casts or scroll up on Apple Podcasts. If you're an audio listener, come check out the video. Come see what we look at, what we look like, and the good work we do here with the video. And check out what Uncle Steve presents to the world as the face of Missed Apex. And if you're a video person, why not subscribe to the podcast version as well? So it's there if you ever need our company whilst driving or mowing the lawn or something. If you like the work we're doing here at Missed Apex Podcast and you want to be part of the army of patrons that help keep this on the road and keep us driving forward and are giving us great ambition for things to do in 2022, then we would appreciate you considering supporting us at patreon.com/MissedApex. It's a small monthly payment. There's various tiers of quote-unquote rewards. Some of those rewards are extra shows that are worse, but we also have a nice Slack forum. You can have an ad-free audio feed as well. patreon.com/MissedApex. Link in the show notes below. We will see you, I think, next for the Russian Grand Prix race review, 8 p.m. UK time, live on YouTube. Our patrons get to chat along live in our patron Slack group as well. Hope to see you there. Until next time, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.